Welcome back, Screen Crush. I'm Ryan Airy, and this is all of the Easter eggs, references, and little things you might have missed in Marvel Zombies. Now, if you have not seen the whole series yet, do not worry. We will be going episode by episode and talking about the reveals as they come so you can stay spoiler-free. We have each episode chapter marked below. So let's get into it. Marvel Zombies is loosely based on the 2005 limited series written by Robert Kirkman, who of course went on to create The Walking Dead. And the TV series is actually a continuation of the season one episode of What If Zombies? Now, that came out 4 years ago, so here's a quick refresher in case you don't remember what led up to this. Janet Van Dyne brought back a zombie virus from the Quantum Realm, and it infected Earth's mightiest heroes. When Bruce Banner came to Earth to warn about Thanos, the world was decimated except for a handful of superheroes. Survivors. They go to Camp Lehigh and discover that the Vision is containing a zombified Wanda by feeding her people, including parts of T'Challa. They try to fight Wanda, a ton of them die, including Okoye.
Wakanda forever!
And Vision rips the Mind Stone out of his head in hopes of a cure, and the remaining survivors head to Wakanda. Then we end on this cliffhanger.
Even in the darkest of times, humans will give all to save their planet. Even if it might bring an end to the universe.
So that episode of What If is great, but it definitely holds back on some of the blood and guts of the comic book. But right away, the series makes it clear that it's upping the ante on the gore with this literal blood-soaked intro. Now, during the title card, if you listen closely, you can hear a ton of whispers under the loud music. And that clues us into the main villain of the series, but again, no spoilers yet. Now, the way the title card opens, bursting through the silence, is an homage to several famous horror openings, both versions of The Evil Dead, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and most famously, Insidious. So this opening kill feels like an homage to Kirkman because he also, like I said, created The Walking Dead. Daryl Dixon is the most popular crossbow-wielding zombie killer around, and while he didn't appear in the comics, he did become the face of the television series. Then we see some familiar faces, Kate Bishop, Riri Williams, and Kamala Khan. But these are not the same girls that we met in the MCU. Because the outbreak occurred before Infinity War, they never met their heroes. Riri hasn't even completed the suit that we see in Wakanda Forever, and Kamala doesn't have her full costume. Now, the one exception here is Kate Bishop. Her costume is the same, but given how they talk later,
your favorite Avenger tries to eat you.
I think this was just a natural evolution during the apocalypse, and she never personally met Clint.
Wait. So how does Kamala got them superpowers? She didn't get them till after Endgame.
Well, that's when she got her powers in Earth 616, but in this series, she says,
maybe she just had a feeling, like the one my nanny had that made her send me my bangle.
Her powers were activated by the bangle, so if she got her bangle earlier, then she also gets her powers earlier. Also, Kamala has this patch of a pink sloth with wings, and we see the same design in her room at the beginning of Ms. Marvel. So then they walk to Grand Central, which of course is the site of the Chitauri invasion in the Avengers, and the walk there gives us a good sense of when this takes place. In What If, the greenery is still all manicured, signaling that the infection was fairly recent. But here, everything is overgrown and falling apart. I also loved this shot of the cracked glass. It reminded me of the What If intro, where all the realities splinter apart. And then we get the Quinjet crash.
Oh, who's that guy in the Quinjet?
Is he like dead?
I'm gonna be honest, we're not 100% sure, but I think it's Eric Selvig. Now I'm basing this on the hairline and the shirt. Also, he is an extremely smart astrophysicist who worked for SHIELD before. And then we see a signature Hawkeye move. And this is exactly the area we last saw him in What If.
It's Hawkeye.
Now, seeing these three team up is also probably giving us a glimpse of the future of the MCU, when, dear God, hopefully we will see the Young Avengers, which would include these three characters plus other characters like Cassie Lang, Patriot, and Wanda and Billy Maximoff. So immediately, Kate Bishop takes the lead, which makes sense because she's rumored to be the leader of the Young Avengers, you know, whenever they actually debut. Now, after they escape, we cut to Bishop Manor, which is pulled directly from the comics. Kate says,
Riri has us all beat. Stealing armor from Tony Stark's headless body.
Which is a reference to this scene in What If.
Allah.
So Riri says the device is a cross-galactic transmitter. Now, we've never seen this transmitter in the MCU, but they're pretty common fare in sci-fi stories. They're used in both Star Wars and Star Trek. When Kate argues with Riri, she says,
we have everything we need here,
except hope of any kind.
Which echoes Spider-Man's sentiment in the original What If episode.
Can we really take that risk?
It's not risk. It's hope.
Also, I just gotta say, I love this dynamic. It is so much fun to see them play off each other, and it makes me really excited for what's to come, whenever they form the Young Avengers or the Champions. Whenever that happens, I'm really looking forward to it. So Riri calls the car
the
Uhura?
Which is a reference to the Star Trek character from Those Old Scientists. Now, in Ironheart, Riri is a huge Trekkie, but Uhura is not her favorite character. It's actually Spock. The gang, leaving their safe haven in New York to trek across the country to find survivors or hope for a cure, is also a classic zombie movie trope. We saw it in Zombieland, 28 Days Later, Dawn of the Dead, Walking Dead, and more recently in The Last of Us. After they leave, they get caught in the storm. Of course, more zombies. Riri whips out this move, an homage to the classic Iron Man movie. Now, once again, we see Kate in the lead giving commands just like Cap used to.
Delta formation, go!
And I love that they clearly helped Kamala gain practice with her powers. It actually reminded me a lot of Steve and Wanda in Civil War.
Wanda, just like we practiced.
And the move they call out, Delta Formation, includes Kamala forming a Delta symbol with her powers to pave a path through zombies. And then we see the source of the storm, Icarus and Captain Marvel. And this shocked me. After Kevin Feige said there were certain Phase 4 characters we wouldn't see again, I thought the Eternals were completely done for. But it does raise some questions. He's not a zombie because the Eternals are basically robots and androids can't be infected. But why is he fighting Captain Marvel? My guess is that in this universe, the Eternals are still hoping for Tiamat to emerge and Captain Marvel would just kill so many people that they had to keep her forever distracted with Icarus. Also, notice that Carol Danvers is wearing the same suit that we saw at the end of Captain Marvel.
But why is she on Earth? I thought she was in space that whole time.
Well, I think Nick Fury definitely used the pager when the zombie outbreak happened. Kate's beloved trick arrow is the confetti arrow that we originally saw in What If? Happy Hogan Saved Christmas. And then Kate gets eviscerated. One thing I love about this series and the original What If episodes is that they are not afraid to have people die. In other Marvel projects, the stakes can sometimes feel low because everybody feels safe, because they're all IP that needs to be protected. But this scene immediately sets the stakes very high for the rest of the show. And then, oh my god, it finally happens, the first appearance of Blade in the MCU.
Oh my god, okay, it's happening!
Unless you count Deadpool and Wolverine.
There's only been one Blade. There's only ever gonna be one Blade.
Are you sure about that?
Blade is an awesome character in the comics. He's a half-vampire, half-human hunter who took up hunting to avenge his mother's death. Marvel announced an official Blade movie all the way back in 2019 starring Mahershala Ali. We even heard his voice at the end of The Eternals.
Sure you're ready for that, Mr. Whitman?
And then it was put on indefinite hiatus and we weren't sure if we would ever get Blade until now.
Yeah, I can't believe Mahershala Ali is finally playing Blade.
Well, not exactly. So I think this Blade is based on Mahershala Ali, but he doesn't actually voice him.
All right. Jeez.
I know, buddy. So this costume design is immaculate. In What If the Hulk fought the Mech Avengers, we see the typical all-white Moon Knight suit. But here, they merge the Moon Knight suit with Blade's typical all-black style. Even his bike has a Moon Knight style accent. It is just so cool. So then we cut to the North Institute in Ohio. OH! We originally saw the North Institute in Black Widow. It was the shield base that Alexei and Milena infiltrated. Now we get another Black Widow reference with this technology.
A neurological agent developed to control humans works even better on zombies.
This was the same tech that Milena was developing in the movie.
Stop breathing.
The wall of zombies that Milena's using to hide their base is also very similar to the Walking Dead mythos of masking yourself in zombie guts and blood to blend in with the undead. Using the horde of zombies masks them from Wanda's zombie army, like Rick and Glenn in The Walking Dead Season 1 using blood to disguise themselves as walkers. And these are some of the widows that Natasha freed at the end of the film. Once they unlock the transmitter, we see footage of this shield base. So this watchtower looks really similar to the tower that we see in Camp Lehigh. However, it might just be a coincidence. After all, the base was overrun at the end of What If Zombies, so they would have had to resecure it at some point. And then we see the zombie horde and its best superhero members. We have Clinton Okoye as well as the Abomination and Ghost. Now, we know from She-Hulk that Abomination was in an LA prison, so Okoye could have picked him up along the way. And Ghost was originally present at the original outbreak in San Francisco. Oh, and of course, Captain America.
I thought Bucky killed him in What If?
Nope, the only way to kill them is a shot through the head. Bucky just split him in half. Also, that is a reference to Iron Man in the original comics. He spends like half the run as only a torso. So this attack is definitely a reference to the Battle of Winterfell from Game of Thrones, specifically the moment when the Unsullied go up against the Nightwalkers. Come on, And of course, it is framed like a classic pitched battle between two sides. It also calls to mind the Battle of Stirling and Braveheart, especially how one side uses long sticks as a defense against the approaching horde. The Widows defending the base from the zombie horde calls back to famous scenes in several zombie movies like Land of the Dead, the 2004 Dawn of the Dead remake, and 28 Weeks Later. And then we get a classic Marvel hallway fight, and notice that Yelena is wielding the Natasha Romanoff-style batons instead of the Red Room-style batons. And then we get this epic Ghost and Blade face-off. Blade is the perfect adversary for her because he has superhuman senses. Even when she's phased, he can tell where she is. Also notice that he loses his cape and his costume becomes more black as he fights. Unlike Mark Spector, he's not using Khonshu's powers. This is 100% him. Melina's death is very Final Destination coded with its framing. Now, we don't see the moment of impact, but rather the reaction to it, her eyes widening and the spear sticking out from the other end. It calls to mind several deaths from that franchise, like the flagpole scene or the nail gun scene in Final Destination 3. After Blade kills Ghost, they escape and prepare to start their quest for a spaceship. And that's it for episode 1. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I loved that first episode. It was so fast-paced, and I think Marvel really nailed the horror aspect. I mean, they didn't flinch from the gore in this one. And I also love seeing all of these characters from different corners of the universe finally interacting. I mean, without Avengers movies in this phase, we've missed a lot of the fun of watching dynamics between different characters, and it's just awesome to see that. Now, I want to take a second to give you guys some bittersweet news. On Friday, October 10th, we are going to have our last live show at the tour in New York during New York City Comic Con. Doing these live shows has been a huge privilege for me. We have been all over the country performing to great crowds, and we've given you things like you can't get on the YouTube channel, like exclusive breakdowns, live Q&As, best of all, live facts with you guys where we just get to chill and hang out together and geek out. But it's also let us put together a truly unique show. It's stuff that we couldn't really do on the YouTube channel because it's all about being live and in person and reacting to each other in real time. They have been an absolute blast. So we figured the best way to end the tour was during Comic-Con. So if you are already in New York for Comic-Con, you're going to be walking around all day, your feet are going to hurt, don't worry, that night, Friday, 6 o'clock at City Winery, we're there for you. You can sit down, rest, chill out. But the best part of the live shows is just getting to meet you guys face to face. Normally, this is how we talk to each other, right? I'm on a screen, you're wherever you are, you're probably pooping. Are you pooping? Don't bring your phone in the shower. If you're pooping, don't poop in the shower either. So the live shows are great because it gives us a chance to, you know, meet and talk and share what we're thinking about all the weird geek stuff going on right now. So if you can, the ticket links are below. It's going to be so much fun. I can't wait for you guys to see what we have planned for you. Now, back to the plot holes. On to episode 2. Here we see the start of the outbreak, much like the prequel comic Marvel Zombies Dead Days. Now, the outbreak takes place before the events of Shang-Chi, so notice he's still working as a valet. And even before he reveals his fighting skills to Katie, there are just little hints, like how he casually runs over a car here. And then Jimmy Woo comes on the scene, and I just love how they wove these two storylines together. To be perfectly honest, it never even occurred to me that Shang-Chi and Scott were in the same city during Ant-Man 2, and this is a great way to use that shared universe. And then we get a nod to this classic Apocalypse Now shot. We also get a very cool Godzilla reference. When Zhu Wenwu takes out this giant zombie, we hear this musical sting, which is a reference to the iconic Godzilla theme. When Zhu Wenwu gives Shang-Chi the rings, he does the same head tilt when he surrenders that he does when he surrenders to the dragon in Shang-Chi. Also, from this point on, Shang-Chi only has 9 rings. Throughout the rest of the series, the ring on his bicep never moves and never stops glowing. It is constantly channeling energy to keep the infection from spreading. And then we cut to 5 years in the future, a very intentional parallel to Avengers Endgame. And this entire sequence is a reference to the classic apocalypse movie, Mad Max. And Shang-Chi and Katie's duet is, of course, a nod to their love of karaoke. Also, Jimmy is still wearing his police badge. The Band of Skrulls is a perfect addition because it shows just how society has completely devolved. Remember, the plague started way before the show's Secret Invasion, so at this time, all the Skrulls were still pretending to be human and were probably working for Nick Fury undercover. But now that there are no governments and there are zombies everywhere, they're just using their real faces because honestly, who can stop them?
So wait, can the Skrulls still get infected since they're aliens?
Well, according to the comics, no, they are not immune. Then we cut to the City on the Sea entrance. And baby, Baron Zemo is back. When the infection broke out, he was in prison because of everything that happened in Civil War. In Earth 616, he ended up in a containment center under Ross, but it's possible that in this world, he was sent to the Raft and took it over after the outbreak. Also, notice that he is back in his iconic costume. Aw, he even got John Walker a matching outfit.
Cute.
Zemo is actually very considerate with his uniforms. Even his soldiers have a little patch bearing his signature maroon. Zemo taking power and sacrificing some people for the greater good is very on brand for many post-apocalyptic zombie movies. We saw this in 28 Days Later with The General and in The Last of Us with David and his cannibalistic cult. Zombie media often expose humankind as the true monsters and how their disrespect for life disappears in a world with so little humanity. Now, this is probably the best reality for Zemo because, once again, he is treated like royalty. And I love this detail while he's giving his grand speech. It's very poignant given Yelena's last appearance in Thunderbolts.
Daddy, I'm so alone.
Now, while this world might be overrun with zombies, she at least has her father. And as they're eating dinner, Blade says,
I no longer consume blood.
And this is a reference to the serum that Blade consumes in the comics. The serum strengthens him and stops his bloodlust. And even in this timeline, Jimmy Woo still has a knack for close-up magic.
Oh, I think I found it.
Behind your ear?
Can you knock?
And then we see the people of Talokan, and notice this is definitely a whale carcass. Now, since they're not exactly humans, I'm not sure if their hunger isn't only for human flesh, or if they're just really desperate, given that they're at the bottom of the ocean. And then we see the zombified Namor. Now, in the comics, there are three variants of Namor that fall to the virus, including one who was killed by Blade. We cut to inside the Raft, and pay attention to this.
And if their boss shows up?
That's what we have heroes for.
So, Walker knows exactly what Zemo is doing, and he's okay with it. It highlights his base nature and how, in every universe, he could never be Captain America because he's not a hero. While Shang-Chi fights to save the survivors, Walker will happily sacrifice people in order to ensure his own safety. The only thing different about his design is his teeth. Instead of human teeth, he has shark teeth, and that is specific to him. The other zombies have normal teeth, and when he roars, he literally matches his throne. Zemo says,
Activate the Hunk Containment Cell!
And this is a modified, sturdier version of the cell that we first saw in The Avengers. And I love this fight scene. It is so well done. It genuinely reminds me of an Avengers fight because of the way it weaves together all of their skills and fighting styles. Now, when Namor chases them down, we start to see the parallels between this show and Multiverse of Madness because this looks so similar to Wanda hunting America Chavez. Also, I'm glad Marvel committed to the horror aspect for this fight because it's just so damn good. It's not just the blood, but the details. John Walker gasping like a fish is freaky. And notice, he was split in half just like Cap. Once again, he can't help but follow in Steve Rogers' footsteps. And Kamala exploding him with her powers is super cool, but it also marks a change in her. When she did the Delta formation, she was fighting to escape, but now she's fighting to kill. Yelena opens the escape hatch, and when she can't join, she says,
It's okay. This is a good death.
Which is a direct reference to this line in Black Widow.
This would be a cool way to die.
And then they head off to New Asgard. So I think this was a perfect second episode. It kept everything moving and really doubled down on the horror aspects. So on to episode 3. Here we are finally picking up at the What If episode.
So why is Scott still a flirting head?
Well, because he was infected, but then the vision cured him, but he had to remove his body to do it. I also think it's a reference to Hope's fate in the comics. Also notice that Black Panther is missing a leg. A reminder that, well,
thought he was saving me. He was just picking up takeout.
We get the same kick-ass entrance from Thor, Groot, and Rocket that we got in Infinity War, but unfortunately, Thor makes the same mistake.
Gone for the head.
When Thanos uses the Power Stone against them, Rocket disintegrates in the same way the Guardians of the Galaxy started to in the first movie. Peter calls the capital of Wakanda the Golden City, a reference to its founding by T'Challa's ancestors, the Golden Tribe. Also, it's amazing how agile T'Challa is, even with a missing leg. We see the same thing in the comics. T'Challa even gets offended when somebody suggests that he is not capable of fighting anymore. When Peter pulls Stormbreaker out of Thanos, we see this green glow because Thanos used the Time Stone to heal the wound.
Man, he's learning pretty fast.
I know. Now, after Thanos is pummeled into the ground, his gauntlet rises out of the ground. And this is visually similar to the classic Evil Dead poster, and even Freddy Krueger's claw hand ripping out of the bed in Nightmare on Elm Street and New Nightmare. So, when Peter throws T'Challa the Mind Stone, we hear his classic theme. and notice when Thanos punches him, instantly his suit starts to glow blue. And that's because his suit absorbs kinetic energy, and that is what gives him the strength to tackle Thanos. And then he saves the day.
Well, wait, if vibranium can destroy the stones, why didn't they just hit them with Cap's shield back in Infinity War?
Well, the vibranium didn't exactly destroy the stones. See, the stones house pure energy from the Big Bang. So the vibranium destroyed the casing, but not the energy itself, which is why the energy immediately starts wrecking havoc on everything around it. It just doesn't have a container anymore. It's free flowing. And then Peter is pulled through a portal, kind of a reverse version of his entrance in Endgame. We cut to Karmar Taj, where we see Rintra, Sarah Wolf, and the London Master. And yes, they never give him a name. In the comics, he's just the London Master. Anyways, we weren't introduced to any of these characters until Multiverse of Madness, so their inclusion immediately tips us off to where this story is headed.
Spain?
No, not Spain. So, on New Asgard, Valkyrie's made quite the display of these zombie heads. These can also be a nod to Valkyrie in the comics. While the MCU version is typically seen with a sword, in the comics, she has a spear. These impaled heads could also be a nod to another one of Kirkman's works, The Walking Dead. In season 9 of that show, we saw Alpha, one of the antagonists, mark her territory by placing walker heads on spikes as a gruesome warning, similar to what Valkyrie did here. Also, notice that the Refuge of the Gods looks similar to the refuge that Heimdall used in Ragnarok. Once inside, we see a ton of statues, most notably this statue of Odin. And for all that Valkyrie claims this is a refuge, there's indicators this place is not as safe as she claims. For example, there are these giant scratches on the wall, and this guy is missing his shield. On Thor's throne, we see this rune above him, which roughly translates to inheritance or heritage. This could also be a nod to Loki, especially because it kind of looks like horns. And we even see this rune quickly during the Loki opening credits. Shout out to BigBoy2536 on Reddit for that observation. Also, this is a completely new look for Thor. He's no longer wearing his signature costume, just typical Asgardian soldier garb. So Wanda pretends to be the Queen of Sokovia, and Zemo points out,
"Sokovia has no queen."
But this could be a nod to the storyline in the comics where Wanda marries Doom, and, while not technically, does live at the castle and everything. Notice that Wanda doesn't have a Sokovian accent, which is always a tip-off that she's messing with reality.
There's been a misunderstanding.
Inside the Hex, she also sounded completely American.
What happened to your accent?
What happened to yours?
Kamala says,
"You sent your scions after us,"
which is yet another parallel to Multiverse of Madness when Wanda sent this demon eyeball thing to capture America Chavez. Also, in Multiverse, we only see Wanda's true face for a moment when she kills Professor X inside his head. The rest of the movie, she's putting on a glamour like she is here.
Do I look dead to you?
Wanda says,
"Over time, I found a way to focus my powers and control my thoughts and myself. I regained my ability to sculpt reality."
And honestly, this is way more in line with the comics than what we see in What If. In the comics, the heroes retain their personalities. They even feel guilty until they get hungry. In the show, the zombies, at least the powerful ones, evolve back into their personalities. And this isn't just Wanda. Thanos was actively learning. And though evil and serving Wanda, Okoye seems to have strands of her original personality as well. When Wanda reveals her illusion, she does it with the same red hand flare that she used in Multiverse of Madness. Alexei also takes way longer to transform into a zombie, and I'm betting that's because of the super soldier serum in his blood. God, this fight is brutal. I know I keep saying it, but we're just so glad that Marvel let people die. It gives the series so much more stakes.
I will honor you.
As they're running, Blade does a classic Moon Knight style hop off the stairs. And this is the famous Grandmaster party ship from Ragnarok. Now, when Wanda talks to Kamala, we're actually hearing from Kamala's perspective. If you listen closely, you can hear Wanda whispering inside her head.
Listen, we can hear the world.
I ad-libbed that line.
Just before they leave, Thor says,
"You're the Avenger now."
And come on, guys, this has to be hinting at Young Avengers, right? It just has to be. So this happy flight is a parallel to an early scene in Endgame. In both cases, the whole crew is so excited to be in space, and they have all this hope. And then that hope just comes crashing down. When the Nova Corps show up, they are in the shield position that we have seen in Guardians of the Galaxy. And funny enough, this isn't the first time this year we've seen a population left to fight the zombie plague.
If I had a nickel for every time I was doomed by a puppet, I'd have 2 nickels, which isn't a lot, but it's weird that it happened twice, right?
All right, I'm not going to leave you guys waiting. On to the finale. Now, this opening scene is loaded with references. As the Nova Corps chases them, Blade says,
"This is them helping. They're preventing the spread of the zombie plague to the rest of the universe."
Now, in the comics, not only does the plague spread far and wide, but the infected heroes of Earth go to other planets just to eat more people. Shang-Chi says,
"What did you do?"
"I don't know, man. I've never been to space before."
Which feels like a reference to this.
"Who here hasn't been to space?"
And as they fall to Earth, Valkyrie says,
I wonder if this is considered dying in battle.
Because as Guardian warriors only go to Valhalla if they die during a fight.
I hate to break it to you, but for a warrior to get into Valhalla, you have to die in the battle. Maybe your arm is in Valhalla.
That's not comforting.
And then this series and the What If episode finally meet when the crew is pulled into Karmar Taj. Also, I doubt this is a reference because the game is relatively new, but this line,
all white, huh? It's a bold choice for a zombie apocalypse.
Is a fun parallel to this interaction in Marvel Rivals.
The worst part about white costumes? The bloodstains. Am I right?
The red hue appearing through the smoke is a direct reference to Wanda's attack on Karmar Taj in Multiverse of Madness. And then we find out that Bruce is still alive. Kind of. And this honestly surprised me because it's a big departure from the comics. Remember, the last time we saw Bruce, he was going into a field of the undead. Since he turns into a zombie in the comics, you know, we assumed that he would do that here too. But it seems like his impenetrable skin saved him. But the Infinity Energy would be too much, even for him, which explains the runes. This is the Guardians of Ashanti spell that we first saw in What If Doctor Strange Lost His Heart Instead of His Hands. And this pose that he hits is a reference to the Greek myth Atlas. So Atlas was a titan who fought against Zeus, and then he was punished to hold up the earth for eternity. Many famous artworks depict him in this kneeling position. So we cut to the final battle, and man, we get some iconic battle references here. For example, Okoye is holding the front of the line, just like she did in both Infinity War and Endgame. But the fighting style is very different. In fact, it's less like the heroes and more like Thanos. Army. Instead of the leaders running head-on with their army, they're hanging back and throwing bodies at the problem. We also get the weirdest version of a rematch between the Abomination and the Hulk. As the Hulk fights, he's not even touching anyone.
Yeah, I mean, how does that work? Is that like when the Thing punches you from across the map in Rivals?
Kind of, actually. He's wielding the energy of the stones. So instead of actually making contact with his fists, he is using his fists to throw energy their way. So the Asgardians appear in the same boats that we saw used as tourist traps in Love and Thunder. And then, oh my God, when the heroes jump out, we hear the Avengers theme. And that makes total sense because this really is their endgame. They tried to save the universe once and it didn't work. But now, exactly 5 years later, they got a second chance. But they are less organized than the Avengers that we know. They didn't even have anybody to say,
assemble.
So instead, we got this. We see just how much Kamala's grown when she uses a move similar to the Delta formation, but instead of just pushing the zombies away, it cuts off their heads. She isn't the same girl that we saw in episode 1. She is not fighting to escape. She is fighting to kill. The London Master uses runes to stop the zombies, many of which are the same runes Agatha used against Wanda. So my guess is that he prevented Wanda from using her magic, and then he could... Then the London Master uses a splicing spell, just like we saw Strange use in Multiverse of Madness. Now, when Valkyrie crawls through Janet, it reminded me of Drax in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, but she also hits the same pose that she hit in Love and Thunder. Wanda gets into Kamala's head, just like she did to this poor guy in Multiverse. And notice this phrasing. In Multiverse, one of the hardest things for her was feeling like she killed Vision for no reason.
I blew a hole through the head of the man I loved. And it meant... nothing.
And she's leveraging that same feeling in Kamala. And when the battlefield fills with red smoke, it is a reference to this. And then we get Zombie Thor, and I love that he has the same badass entrance that he uses when he's coming to save the day, except now he's coming to doom it. Also, it's fun to see Zombie Thor. I mean, in the comics, he falls to the plague pretty early, and he's a fun part of the story. Now, of course, this is the Hulk and Thor rematch from Ragnarok, and the Hulk even finishes him off with the same move. But then Wanda rolls up with the same sting from Multiverse. And we get more parallels here.
We can fix this.
Both versions of Wanda are motivated by the same thing, pain. In WandaVision, a subconscious part of her thought that she could fix it.
You can fix anything, Mom. Fix dead.
But by Multiverse of Madness, she consciously believed this, just like she does here. But Kamala is closer to where Wanda was in WandaVision. She doesn't want to hurt anybody. But she can't handle everything she's lost. And notice the Infinity Stone energy spreads in a way that is similar to the Hex. And then Kamala wakes in her room. And notice there are superhero posters in her room, but none of Captain Marvel. So in this delusion, she sees Kamran, her love interest from Ms. Marvel. And then we see Riri, and she reaches out using the same words that Jimmy used to reach out to Wanda in the Hex.
Wait, she's still alive?
Yeah, she made a cure. You actually see her stab herself with it all the way back in episode 1. And what does a cure provide? Hope. And therein lies the big problem with Wanda's plan. This isn't like the Hex from WandaVision. Now, I'm sure a lot of people would be fine with their fake world if their other option was getting eaten. But even here, living in a delusion means that people stop trying to fix the world. They settle for a fantasy. But people need hope, real hope, to survive.
You gave that to all of us. And I'll always be grateful to you for that.
So I love this cliffhanger. Now, we don't know if we're going to get a sequel yet, but even if there isn't, I think this is a great way to end the movie. George A. Romero said it best.
Always at the end, it sort of gets set back up again. We kill the monster, you know, we do whatever we need to. And I didn't want to do that.
And that's everything on Marvel Zombies. Like, I know that was a lot, but what did you guys think? Do you want a sequel? Do you like the blood and guts? Let us know in the comments below. And also, major shout out to Brianna McLarty, the writer of this video. You can find her social links below. And if it's your first time here, please subscribe, smash that bell for alerts. For Screen Crush, I'm Ryan Airy.